This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasudhi. Colorectal cancer has overtaken lung cancer as the second most common cancer among Malaysians, raising serious concerns about our poor dietary habits, especially the consumption of foods high in saturated fats. According to the World Health Organization's Globokan 2008 report, 1 in 33 Malaysians are at risk of developing colorectal cancer. And with me in the studio today is histopathologist Dr. Sri Ganesh Kalimuthu. He's going to enlighten us on a tissue level what's actually going on with colorectal cancer. Welcome, Dr. Sri. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for having me again.
You know, just to recap, Dr. Sri, what is colorectal cancer? How does it even start? You know, do you want to just go through that?
Well, colorectal cancer is categorized as malignant tumors that occur in the colon. So it just encompasses the region anywhere from it doesn't include small intestinal cancer, as in, while some of them are similar morphologically to colorectal cancer, they are lumped in a separate group, and colorectal cancer is are cancers that occur anywhere from the cecum, which is in the right side of the colon, to the rectum, which is pretty much where the last stop before it gets into the anus. So it refers to a group of cancers, and they usually refer to the cancers that are talked about covered in colorectal cancer. When you say colorectal cancer, it implies that these tumors are of the malignant epithelial type. That means they arise from the glands that line the colonic mucosa.
Okay.
There are other forms of colorectal cancer. Perhaps you could get a lymphomatous involvement of colorectal cancer of the colon. There could be a neuroendocrine type carcinoma, but they are the rarer sorts, or a soft tissue tumor involving the colon. They are very rare.
Okay.
But when colorectal cancer, the term is used, the connotation is that it means that it is an epithelial tumor that occurs in the colon.
Polyps is how it all begins?
Polyps, it's variable, but generally thought to arise from polyps. There are two types of polyps to speak of. One is the hyperplastic or regenerative polyps. They're benign. They occur secondary to inflammation. There is a molecular pathway that occurs, but it does not progress to malignancy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a hyperplastic polyp, and that's a very common finding that you would see when one goes for a colonoscopy. They would snare the polyp, and it's reported as hyperplastic polyp. I mean, I would recognize it as a hyperplastic polyp. The story ends there, and that's it. Whereas with polyps that are considered to be precancerous would be the tubular adenomas and the villous adenomas that have pre-malignant changes of the epithelium, which is called dysplasia. And generally, small polyps which have low grade, it's the type of dysplasia is divided into a two-tier system. One is a low grade and one is a higher grade. Mm-hmm. The higher grade ones are the ones that raise concern and that could progress to cancer. If left alone and not attended to, it is possible that these polyps, through a cascade of molecular genetic events, can develop into cancer.
Histological types of colorectal cancer, is that what you just spoke to us about?
Yeah, histological types of colorectal cancer would generally look at the morphology, the appearance of the cancer. And the commonest one is the adenocarcinoma. Adeno means it arises from glands. And what a gland is, and I was thinking about it, you know, how do you explain a gland to someone who's not quite au fait with the topic when you do not have pictures?
Mm-hmm.
What a gland is a ovoid, an oval-shaped donut.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of...
It's
got a ring in the center, but it's elongated and it's lined by a layer or several layers of cells. And in the case of the colon, it's just a single layer of cell. And if you look at it, it is a slightly elongated version of a donut. That's what it is.
Okay.
And these colorectal cancers are generally adenocarcinomas, and they can be divided, they're graded into three types: the well differentiated to the poorly differentiated, well, moderately, and poorly differentiated. Well, the terms well differentiated moderately and poorly differentiated basically mean this. Well differentiated refers to how close the tumor is to its native tissue that it arose from, and poorly differentiated would mean that it's so very different and so quite aggressive in comparison to its native gland structure that it is quite aggressive. Moderate would be somewhere in between. You'd still see a certain degree of gland formation, and the books say that it should be between 50-95% of gland formation, whereas poorly differentiated carcinomas will have less than 5%. 5 to 50%, so to speak.
Do we know the mechanisms that lead to the development of colorectal cancer?
There are several mechanisms, and the known ones are the molecular genetic mechanisms, and it all starts from the adenomatous polyposis coli gene, which is a tumor suppressor gene.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is an aberration, a tumor suppressor gene literally means that it not that it actively suppresses tumor, it's a gene that regulates programmed cell death and proliferation of cells. Our bodies constantly the cells of the colon are constantly in regenerating.
Like the BRCA gene.
It's also like a BRCA gene. It's essentially all, I mean, we're going through, the body is going through, or the various cellular systems or the tissue systems are going through processes of proliferation and programmed cell death in order to keep the tissue, I suppose,
renewed.
The tissue renewed and mm-hmm. in optimal function.
Yeah.
When things go wrong, when these tumor suppressor genes, which regulate the programmed cell death and the proliferation of the cells, when that goes wrong, when programmed cell death is averted and it gains a pathway whereby it starts to aberrantly grow,
mm-hmm.
and the cascade of molecular mechanisms or molecular genetic mechanisms that take place with the beginning of APC's knockoff is what leads to colorectal cancer. There are several molecular genetic pathways that cause development of colorectal cancer. Another known mechanism is called microsatellite instability.
Mm-hmm.
A microsatellite is a known occurrence in our genetic signature, which is a locus of genes that result in several tandem repeats. What microsatellite instability means is that the in replication of our DNA, things aren't perfect, and there are these mismatch repair genes that look into that do the proofreading to make sure that the copies are perfect, and if there are any problems, it repairs them.
Okay.
If the mismatch repair genes are not working, there is a repeat section of certain genes that result in a abnormal microsatellite. And high levels of microsatellite instability in a genetic signature of an individual leads to something called the hereditary non-polyposis coli syndrome, whereby the colon is filled with multiple polyps and it increases the chances of developing a tumor. So that's one known mechanism.
So when you talk about microsatellite, you're talking about the gene patterns appearing more than they should?
Abnormal gene patterns that appear more than they should. Microsatellites is an accepted occurrence, but abnormal appearance of these aberrant microsatellites that indirectly mean that the repair gene that looks into the correctness of our genetic signature is not working. So that molecular mechanism is an established mechanism in terms of a certain type of syndrome.
Would that also be associated, similar concept to people with Down syndrome who have more chromosomes than they actually should?
Well, that occurs in vivo.
Okay.
And in vivo when the basic building blocks of an embryo is being set up, and that there is an added chromosome 21,
yep,
creating a genetic signature that from the off the bat is very abnormal.
So how different is that from this?
Well, generally, the individuals who carry microsatellite instability are genetically normal, but because that there is an inherent problem with the repair, it results in in these collections of microsatellite instabilities that do not affect our appearance or function,
mm-hmm.
in as fundamentally as Down syndrome does or trisomy 21 does.
What would affect that balance? or what causes it to go awry?
The person with microsatellite instability has normal chromosomes. Anyone who has microsatellite instabilities would have normal chromosomes. It's just that these little clusters, these patterns occur and accumulate and increase the possibility of developing colon cancer or hereditary non-polyp.
But what would trigger it? I mean, you already have it, right?
Yeah.
But what would trigger it? Do we know?
I think in individuals such as those harboring high levels of microsatellite instability, it would be a given that it would be developing into colon cancer. There is a problem.
It's an assumption.
It's an assumption that it would develop, that the risk is pretty much, let's put it this way, there's a clear and present danger of one developing colorectal cancer. And then you have individuals with apparently no recognizable genetic abnormalities. I mean, they are normal individuals. Yep. It's not a fundamental somatic mutation that result in abnormal appearance of the face or different, you know, in terms of physical appearances. You have essentially what people whom are normal, but who develop colon cancer, and you do these tests, you don't find any microsatellite instabilities and so on and so forth. There could be other pathways, and when we talked about epigenetics on the last show, there is an epigenetic mechanism that is also known to cause colorectal. A combination of epigenetic mechanisms are involved in the development of colorectal cancer. So the message is that some pathways are clearly delineated, some pathways are clearly known and clearly established to be the case. But the story still hasn't unraveled itself. There are more molecular pathways. People are still figuring out how to develop or how to delineate or categorize the different pathways in the hope of developing different therapeutic approaches to tackle these pathways. I mean, in the ideal world, molecular geneticists would love to discover, okay, this is pathway one, this is pathway two, pathway three. We have clear, proven, delineated pathways. Now, what can we do to stop those pathways from resulting from realizing that the final sinister step, which is the development of tumor, which is the development of carcinoma or a colorectal cancer? So that's the eventual goal. I'm sure there are many studies out there that are continually looking at trying to, you know, kind of make the picture clearer. And of course, the nugget at the end is a drug that can look into these things.
The pathways
and treat. And eventually the pharmaceutical industry would be looking at it very closely. So, you know, that's a nugget at the end for these for researchers.
We're discussing colorectal cancer with histopathologist Dr. Sri Ganesh Kalimuthu. If you have a question for him, send it through. The number is 016-201-9000, or you can tweet BFM Radio. When we come back, we'll find out. We have a question here. What are the signs and symptoms that we should be aware of when it comes to colorectal cancer? That's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Meera Sivasuthi. With me, Dr. Sri Ganesh Kalimuthu, histopathologist. We're discussing on a tissue level what's actually going on when it comes to colorectal cancer. It is said to be the second most occurring cancer among Malaysians. Yes. And according to the World Health Organization's Global 2008 report, and this sort of hit me in a big way, 1 in 33 Malaysians are at risk of developing colorectal cancer. What do you think that seems to be the case? Is it our diet? Is it, what do we attribute that to?
It is diet. It's a large part to do with diet. I think genetic mechanisms aside, that only explains part of the picture. Mm-hmm. The other side of things would be the increased consumption of meats, fast food. They are not natural products. A burger from a popular fast food joint that we all know and love, the beef patty would not be 100%, the chicken patty would not be 100%. So there's inclusive of a lot of stuff that we don't know. Increased consumption of preservatives, canned foods, and so on. We could say that we do not consume preservatives, that we are very careful about what we eat and right. So on. I don't think that we can completely avoid the fact that we are consuming increased preservatives by, you know, it could be as from the humble tomato ketchup to the sardine cans. I mean, a lot of preservatives are being used. or if you're buying fruits, in order for the fruits to be to ripen faster, chemicals are being sprayed on it in order to make sure that it ripens fast and it's ready for sale and so on. So, I mean, all these accumulative factors, I think, cumulatively increase the incidence of colorectal cancer. It's not to say that everyone would get it, but incidence is increasing, and that's a fact that we cannot ignore.
Signs and symptoms. We have another question. What should we be aware of?
Well, the signs and symptoms for colorectal cancer is relatively similar to most forms of cancer, in that, you know, the advanced stage cancers would be loss of weight, anemia, tiredness, and so on. These are the kind of the constitutional symptoms. But when it comes to colorectal cancer, there are specific symptoms, and they are mainly related to bowel movements and the feeling of fullness in the anal region and so on. But that depends on where the cancer is. If the cancer develops on the right side of the colon, if the right side of the colon receives digested material that's directly coming in from the small intestine, mm-hmm. and at that stage the waste matter, the fecal matter, isn't solid, it's still more fluid, and therefore it's able to pass through carcinoma that would have encroached in the cavity of the colon, the tubular piping. So imagine something encroaching its pathway and blocking the passage of fecal matter. But in the right side, fecal matter is relatively watery, so you won't get immediate symptoms of bowel motion problems until when the tumor is relatively advanced, that it's nearly completely encroaching the piping. Whereas in you compare it to cancers occurring in the rectum and the distal end, the end point of the colon, you are talking about dealing with hardened fecal matters. So any type of tumor that causes some amount of blockage, you're going to feel, you know, fullness, inability to pass motion, you're going to suffer constipation, and as constipation develops, you'll be passing more mucus, which they call spurious diarrhea, false diarrhea. You're literally passing some very runny like fluid, you think it's diarrhea, and then if you self-treat it with, you know, non-laxatives, it gets worse. So, yeah. You know, it's a kind of a positive feedback, and eventually when the tumor is relatively advanced, you'll feel heaviness in around the anal region, and you'll have the feeling of fullness with small amounts of food. But then by that time that occurs, the constitutional symptoms would be pretty obvious, in that, you know, you would have lost a significant amount of weight, and you would feel tired and so on. So there are a constellation of signs and symptoms. Whilst the constitutional symptoms are pretty general, the manifestation of bowel movement symptoms depends on where the tumor is located.
Okay, but very often it's identified, or it's, you know, we sort of realize this at a much later stage, because symptoms don't present obviously.
They don't, and that's a sad thing. And you could go through the denial, oh, cancer, it'll never happen to me, and then, you know, this is just, I'm just having diarrhea, it's just, or constipated, it's long-term constipation, and you don't look into it.
Okay.
You might fall into the trap of missing a colorectal carcinoma, and especially in elder individuals who just kind of, you know, they're more, the baby boomer generation, they're more stoic than the younger generation, so they kind of, you know, let it fester and let the tumor fester and develop into an advanced stage.
And even then, men far worse than women.
I must admit, women are more stoic than men.
We are, yeah. And we go get our checks done. There's a question here from Adrian. He's saying 2 years he found polyps benign. Do we need to go for another colonoscopy?
I think you should. I think regular colonoscopy is important.
Adrian is 52.
Oh, 52. Mm-hmm. Regular colonoscopy is important. I think if the two polyps are hyperplastic polyps, they're okay. But if it's a tubular adenoma, low-grade dysplasia, it's still, you know, okay. If polyps are well snared and excised, it's okay. But I think it's always good to do regular colonoscopic checkups. And, you know, especially if there's a history of colorectal cancer in the family, maybe through a first-degree relative or something, you should always always get colonoscopic checkups on a regular basis. I think not every 6 months, but you know, once in a year, once in 2 years, mm-hmm. that sort of intervals.
The histologic grading of colorectal cancer is largely subjective, Dr. Sri. I mean, how do you manage that?
The grading is, there is some degree of subjectivity, but that said, there is a clear demarcation between there's a three-tier model of grading colorectal carcinomas: the well-differentiated, the moderate, and the poorly differentiated. And then there is the two-tier model. It's low grade and high grade. I personally like the three-tier model, because if it's neither this or that, you know, it goes into the moderately differentiated, which means it's not great nor is it poor. There is a greater degree of correlation between the well-differentiated and the poorly differentiated adenocarcinomas. The moderates, I think some have different ways of expressing it, you know, moderate to focally poorly differentiated, to express that, you know, whilst the tumor still looks, you know, relatively close to its native structure, it has features that make it appear aggressive in parts. Whilst that there is a small degree of variation in the way the appearances are interpreted, they largely do not impact, there is no significant impact. There's a very mild deviation in the kind of impact that the grading system has on the overall outlook of the tumor. What's very important is that the grading system be combined with the depth of invasion and the stage of the tumor. And the stage of the tumor depends on where the tumor is along the wall of the colon. If it has penetrated the wall, the muscular wall of the colon, and has gone to the pericolic tissues, that is in itself an aggressive, that's stage 3. And if it has penetrated the the peritoneal lining, then it is a stage 4.
Right. And as they say, the colon cancer is, depth is of its invasion is actually most important.
Yes, it is very important in terms of staging the tumor and extraction of lymph nodes. Very, very, very important. There is a general consensus. This is what happens when a colon is resected for tumor. The story here is, it's not a surprise. We know it's colorectal cancer. It's removed for that very purpose. The patient is in no, there's no surprise there. Surgeon knows that it is cancer. A pathologist knows that it's cancer when looking at it. The important, the key part of reporting a colon for colorectal cancer is to include the relevant prognostic markers, or the negative and positive prognostic markers, in the report. And that would include the depth of invasion, which is very important, the presence or absence of vascular permeation. So if the tumor is in a vessel, that the chances are it's spreading through the vascular system, and it could spread. Well, it's basically indicating that this tumor has entered the vascular system and could appear elsewhere as a metastatic focus. So that's a poor prognostic indicator. The presence of invasion around nerves, the presence of inflammation. If there's a great host response, if there's a lot of inflammation around an invasive tumor, it's a good sign. That means there's a host tumor response. So those are prognostic indicators that need to be included in the report. And lymph nodes. The reason why I talk about lymph nodes being important is that the information it gives on prognosticating the relative survival times. I mean, no one is God. No one can tell you have 5 years to live and that's it, you know. But there is that 95% chance. It's always chances. They always express it in terms of chances. You have a 95% chance of surviving 5 years cancer free. Tumors with this stage have that probability. It's always probabilities. And just to illustrate the importance of lymph nodes, you have one report which says 5 lymph nodes were harvested. None of them show involvement of tumor. And then you have another report which says 20 lymph nodes were harvested and none of them show the presence of tumor. So more lymph nodes gives the pathologist a greater level of confidence to say that, you know, look, hey, I looked at 20 lymph nodes and I don't find cancer. So the chances of tumor involving the lymph nodes, based on the numbers I've got, I can be pretty confident to say that they are not involved. Whereas five lymph nodes, you're treading on thin ice, mm-hmm. and you know you can't strongly substantiate it. So with the staging, which involves the depth of the tumor, the involvement of lymph nodes, and the presence of metastatic foci, and you don't know that until the clinician biopsies another part of maybe the liver, if there's a liver nodule that's involved by colorectal cancer and that's proven to be colorectal cancer, you can actually include that in the staging. With good staging, the clinician can actually give a better informed guesstimate to the patient, saying that, you know, your 95% survival rate cancer-free for the next 5 years mm-hmm. is this. And, you know, you can go back with that sort of qualitative, an educated guess as to how long you'd live.
What if the tumor is not grossly visible? Then what happens?
They would be the endophytic tumors, the tumors that don't fungate into or don't grow into the piping system but grow inwards into the muscle system. They present themselves late. They can present themselves as stage 4 rectal cancers. There are certain subtypes of tumors, like tumors with a lot of mucin. They call them the mucinous carcinomas. And then there are tumors that look like signet ring cells. It takes its name from the cross-section of a signet ring.
Mm-hmm.
The signet is placed eccentrically over the ring. If you look at a signet ring on a cross-sectional
yep.
basis,
mm-hmm.
that's what it looks like. And that's what these cells take its name from, a signet ring. They automatically infer that this tumor is going to be behaving aggressively. The ones that grow deep in are the more sinister ones. And they can be late. They can show up themselves quite late. But if they have, if patients come with constitutional symptoms and they go for their colonoscopies, they are able to detect it.
In a grand scale, in the grand scheme of things, Dr. Sri, where do you as a histopathologist fall into all of this? I mean, you are obviously...
Yeah.
What's your microscope's name again?
Betsy.
Betsy, yes.
Betsy, yeah. Betsy.
With Betsy,
yeah.
I mean, you're looking at these tissues, you know, you're looking at these tumors, you're analyzing them. After that, what happens? I mean, in the whole scheme of management of colorectal
yeah.
cancer, where how do you play a part?
Okay, the histopathologist plays a role at three steps. Assuming that these three steps occur. The first step is where the pathologist is most featured in the key step. Patient comes in with all these symptoms, gets a colonoscope done, and there is a huge mass in the colon. It is biopsied. Now, the clinician knows through experience that is tumor. No doubt about it. And the radiology reports would show that this is a tumor, no doubt about it. But they cannot proceed with treatment unless a histopathological diagnosis is made. So that's where the histopathologist comes in. Biopsy is taken, it is processed, and the histopathologist reads it, confirms that it's carcinoma. That's step one, and that's a very important step because there's a correlation or the confirmation that this is a malignant tumor. Now, where do we go next? The patient, if the tumor is relatively early in its stage, the tumor will be excised.
Mm-hmm.
The pathologist will play a role in sampling the colon and providing prognostic information regarding the tumor stage and the spread and the negative prognostic factors, so on and so forth. That's number two. If it is well excised, the story ends there. The histopathologist may not be involved unless the patient comes back a few years later with a metastatic nodule or if there is a cancer recurrence somewhere else in the body and they do a biopsy. The other scenario is, the step one of the other scenario is similar. Biopsy is done to confirm tumor. Number two step is before the second step occurs, this particular type of tumor could be too large to operate. So what they would do is provide chemoradiotherapy. Before surgery to reduce the size. And once the tumor is amenable to surgery, they would remove the colon or depending on which part of it is where the tumor is, they would do an excision of the involved area. The pathologist will the sampling will be slightly different because tumor was proven on the biopsy, but here the chemoradiotherapy may be so effective that mm-hmm. it could actually result in just replacement of the tumor with fibrous tissue.
Right.
So the focus here is to to identify if there is any evidence of residual tumor. And the emphasis of the report would be to provide information as to the response to chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm. So before surgery.
Post-surgery. Response to chemotherapy post and post-surgery, because the tissue is taken out and you're looking at the various amounts of tissue and you're trying to look for cancer. And if you see a very small focus of cancer in the amount of tissue you've sampled, you can give an idea that there is a greater than 80% response to tumor or a greater than 90% response, depending on how you've quantified your sampling.
Right.
And then you provide that prognostic information, which is probably the more important one. And then, of course, you try your hand at harvesting as many lymph nodes as possible to see if there is any involvement of lymph nodes there. And that's another scenario. Then, of course, recurrence of tumor in the same patient, and it could happen. But these are several scenarios that the pathologist would be involved in. But they are key steps in what in processes that the patient never sees.
Mm-hmm. Your message, Dr. Sri?
Colorectal cancer has a severe impact on society, and I think it is, definitely one of the commoner cancers out there. At the end of the day, I suppose prevention is better than cure. Be aware of it. Be vigilant, I suppose, of the signs and symptoms that may ensue. When in doubt, always get it checked up, and to avoid a late detection of what may be colorectal cancer.
Thank you very much for
You're
joining
welcome.
Me. Dr. Sri Ganesh Kalimuthu, a histopathologist on colorectal cancer on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.